This interview is being conducted with Irvin Ozer at his house on Richards Drive in Liberty Township. Mr. Ozer, can you tell me what you do for a living?
I'm Associate Director of the Yucatan Area Jewish Federation.
Where were you born, sir, and where?
I was born in Youngstown, Ohio, 1919.
1919? And were you born at a hospital or were you born at home?
In a hospital. Or so.
Now, can you tell me a little bit about your early education?
Well, when I was junior high, senior high, there was in Youngstown an institution called the Institute of, it's called the Youngstown Hebrew Institute on the corner of Elm Street and Lincoln Avenue, which was sponsored by Temple Emmanuel and Hashem Temple. We conducted after school classes, after public school classes in the evening. After going to Sunday school at the temple, I used to go 4 nights a week there after school. We got on a bus at school and rode down and walked down to school.
And about how many people were involved in this?
I was too young then to really think in terms of numbers, but I would guess there must have been upwards of 100 kids going.
What did you learn at the Institute? What classes did you take?
Well, it was a school which, because it was sponsored by two different temples with two slightly different ideologies, stayed away pretty much from theological sorts of things, but we studied Hebrew, not conversational Hebrew, but liturgical Hebrew. We studied the Bible, we studied biblical history, we studied Talmud, we studied the Torah, most of it in Hebrew.
Could you explain what Talmud and the Torah are?
Well, the Torah, of course, is the five books of Moses, what is called the Old Testament. The Talmud is the interpretation of the Torah, and it evolved over many, many years. First, it was an oral interpretation, which was passed down from one wise man, so to speak, to another, who was responsible for interpreting the Bible, and then gradually it was put to writing. Canonized and became what is now known as the Talmud, and there's further interpretation of Talmud called Gemara and so on. The Mishnah, the Gemara, it's a pretty well thing if you want to get to that now.
Okay.
But I would say that it covered everything in the lives of the Jews down through the years, from complicated legal questions, jurisprudence, down to such things as how to get dressed in the morning and how to get undressed at night.
You were talking earlier about you didn't discuss theological ideas because of the difference in the temples. How many temples were there in this town and what were their differences?
Well, let's see, at that time there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 temples. Temple Emmanuel, there was the Old Hasidic Temple, there was the Shari Torah Temple, there was Anshi Emuk, and there was Shomim. I believe that's all there were at that time.
Shomim of Israel was the chat?
I beg your pardon, yes, Shomim of Israel. I'm sorry, there was 6.
And the Summit Avenue?
The Summit Avenue Temple, I think, was the other name for either the Shari Torah or the Torah Tetapunga. The Shari Torah was.
Okay, and what were the differences in the temples?
Well, as you know, there's three basic schools of thought in Jewish religion. One is Orthodox, one is conservative, and then there's Reform. At that time, I believe, Children of Israel, Shari Torah, Poet Tzedek, and Emmanuel were Orthodox. Moshe Emmett was conservative and wrote a poem in Reform.
Why would there be a need for four Orthodox temples and only one of the other two?
Well, we've got to bear in mind the state or stage Jewish history at that time. Jewish immigration to the United States started way back in the 1700s. And most of the people who came here at that time came from the Western European countries, especially Germany. And Reform Judaism was rather strong in Germany at that time. Those came were very small minorities who had to live amongst the great majority of the Christians. And they tended to assimilate, tended to accentuate the things that were like, and to set aside those things that made them super different. As a result, they practiced what we consider Reform Judaism. They melded into the background, and they came in slowly increasing numbers, and in Youngstown built up a fair-sized community before the turn of the century. But they were they organized the first temple in Youngstown, which was the Dover Stone Temple, which I understand from you first met in somebody's home, is that it?
Yeah, Dr. Theobald.
And then eventually built a temple on the corner of Holmes and I think it was Lincoln, now 5th and Lincoln. But they celebrated their 100th anniversary here about 3 years ago. Then, around the turn of the century, there came a heavy migration from Eastern Europe, from the pogroms in Russia, Poland, Lithuania, Hungary, and so on. And they tended to come en masse as a transplant, bringing more or less the entire shtetl from Europe to
Seattle. Could you explain the word shtetl?
Well, shtetl, of course, ought to be familiar to anybody who saw it. Put it on the roof. They said it was a Jewish town or settlement. It was more or less self-contained with all the institutions to which it was a ghetto town, actually. And they brought with them then their institutions, including the temples. And they would set up in a particular neighborhood, and that neighborhood then took on all the flavor of the European counterpart. And for years, they tended to live more or less in isolation in this ghetto. That's how these different temples got to be set up. One was Polish, another would be Hungarian, and another would be Russian. And God forbid that a youngster from one of these communities should date or fall in love with a girl from another one, because this was almost tantamount to being excommunicated or completely rejected. I understand there were times when people said Kaddish for a son who intermarried with a Jewish girl from another community. Then over the years, it began to break down, and membership in the temple became mixed, those leaders became mixed, and often slow to became decentralized in one sense and centralized in another sense, which we can talk about a little later. But that was the reason that instead of having one temple for Orthodox, one temple for all the Orthodox, for all the Eastern Europeans, we tend to have these separate temples, which each had their own idiosyncrasies, their own traditions and customs and taboos.
Could you explain what the word cottage means?
Cottage is a prayer or an affirmation which is used in the services, Jewish services, in all branches of Judaism, which is basically an affirmation or reaffirmation of faith in God and trust in God. But it is used, amongst other reasons, when a family is faced with the death of a member of the family, a loved one, when instead of praying to God and saying, why'd you do that to me, or why'd you take him or her, you say, in essence, God, I don't know why you did this, but I continue to believe, I have faith in you, what happened must happen, and so forth.
So the feeling between the communities was so strong that if the child would intermarry, they were considered to be dead.
Yeah, only for a very short time.
About how long?
Probably last month. After they got the United States, more than 5 or 10 years, I think, began the break time.
Okay, after you finished your Hebrew Institute, how old were you when you went to the Hebrew school?
I think I went there from about age 9 to probably 16.
And you were confirmed at the age of 16?
I don't know whether it was a confirmation service or a graduation service, but something that I got intensive sets for happened at that time.
What were the differences between a bar mitzvah?
I think if I remember right, we were confirmed from the Temple Sunday School and graduated from the university. Two different things.
Then you went to Sunday school at your temple also,
right?
And what were the differences in the classes at the temple from the institute?
Well, of course, the focus of the Sunday school was more English. You studied the Bible again and some theological aspects, and I frankly don't remember. Didn't rub off the book.
In your life, I assume you were bar mitzvah.
Yes.
And can you tell me a little bit of the difference between the bar mitzvah service then and the bar mitzvah service now? Is there a difference?
Well, a lot depends on the temple institution. A full bar mitzvah today is really very similar to what it was then. The youngsters prepared to conduct all or part of the service is prepared to read from the Torah, and he is prepared to read the portion from the Haf Torah, the Maftar. That's another long story. The service on a Sabbath morning is made up of chakras, which is the preliminary prayers.
Could you say that?
In English? It's a matter of opinion. S-H-A-C-H-R-I-S or I-P, whichever dialect you use. This is followed by the Torah reading service, by the Haf Torah, and then by Musaf, which is the closing part of the service. That's called M-U-S-A-F. Uh, In the days that Israel, the people of Israel were scattered to the diaspora, in many places they were forbidden to read the Torah, out loud at least. And they devised a scheme of not reading the Torah out loud, but reading from the Apocrypha, which is the additional writings which were not canonized as part of the five books of Moses. And usually they tried to tie the people who, in their infinite wisdom back in history, tried to put these things together. They tried to tie something from the Apocrypha, from the non-canonized religious writings, to the spirit of the content of the particular read for that day from the Torah. So the youngster has to learn all the symbols, aside from being able to read it, he's got to learn the various symbols of what's called Nusach, which had a particular sound. And as he reads, he has to not only know the word, but he has to know the particular combination of notes that make up that symbol. And the idea is to demonstrate to the congregation that he has the required knowledge to participate in service, and that he can become part at the time of the adult Jewish community and be counted as an adult.
Was the child at that period of time when you were bar mitzvah considered more of an adult than the 13-year-old child is today?
No. Less. Children today are growing up much faster. They think they're growing up much
faster. In the area of anti-Semitism, did you experience much of that as you were growing up?
Looking back, I would say I did, yeah. Much of it rubbed off, sort of rolled off the back, but some of it made an impression. I think particularly of when I was going to Madison School, having to walk about 10 blocks to and from the school, and having the older kids teasing, calling me type. Constant harassment, including at times physical harassment, getting in fights and so on, because I was Jewish. The covert type of anti-Semitism from that period, I really don't remember.
Were there many areas that were segregated against Jews that didn't belong, clubs or?
Oh yes, that was very prevalent at the time. Most of the country clubs were closed to Jews. Many of them that are open now are closed to Jews at the time. There were areas in Youngstown, areas in Liberty Township that you could buy a house. There are many areas in the business, commerce in Youngstown that a Jew could not go to.
Did this increase or lessen as it came towards World War II?
At that point, I would say just prior to the World War II was the height of such a, oh, I can't think of the names of Paul Coughlin, of Gerald L. K. Smith. Even Henry Ford was an anti-Semitic and expressed it publicly. There were other zealous missionary types on the radio and in public who were anti-Semitic. It was a period where there was a lot of talk about anti-Semitism. And yet, during my college career, just before World War II, I have difficulty thinking of any particular occasion, aside from the fact that was taken for granted that a Jew wasn't going to be asked into a non-Jewish fraternity, and I didn't want to belong to a fraternity anyway, so it didn't particularly bother me. I can't really think of any real anti-Semitism to which I was subjected on a personal level.
Were there any organized activities in the Youngstown as there had been a decade earlier, such as the Klan, that were openly anti-Semitic?
Well, the Klan was very active in and near Youngstown, and having trouble with dates. But it was before World War II, and some of my peers and myself actually would go to these rallies and, with the ideas of breaking them up. One, I believe, if I remember rightly, that Avon, what is now Avon Park, and there we did get in the push and shove sort of thing and broke up the rally. Where but entirely, to my knowledge, never got really strong in this thing.
Where is Avon Park?
It's on 422 between Youngstown and the Strip, on the right side.
Yeah. Yeah. The Avon Ballroom. The Avon Ballroom.
Yeah, in that
area. You say that a group of you went to some of these rallies and got into other marriages. Was there anything, any organized group like the Anti-Defamation League or the Jewish Defense League back then?
Well, JDL, of course, didn't exist. The Anti-Defamation League was in existence, I'm pretty sure. Let's see. American Jewish Congress, American Jewish Committee were all pre-war, but not by much. The preoccupation at that time for most of them was in terms of what was going on in Europe.
Were there any specific Jewish clubs, organized, social or otherwise, that a Jewish person had an alternative to belong to since he wasn't allowed in the non-Jewish fraternities?
Yeah, you talk about Youngstown.
Youngstown, yes. Just
in general. In some communities, of course, by that time they had their own country clubs, which I'm opposed to. But socially, there were always organizations for young men. There was the Mogen Dovid in Youngstown, AZA,
could you explain what those were?
It was a Zionist organization. Well, Mogen Dovid means the Blue Star of David. It was a social club, fraternal club, of young men. The AZA and BBG, of course, were the B'nai B'rith clubs, which were national, which had each had their own programs.
Were those youth-oriented clubs also?
AZA and BBG definitely youth, but they covered a greater period at that time than they do now, because they went to college. Here on the local level, there were fraternities and sororities sprang up and then. Not until the Jewish Community Center was organized, was there an actual community-wide effort. Standard, not the standard, but the centralized club structure.
What did you do during the war?
Well, shortly after I graduated from college in 1941, I enlisted in the Air Force. Pilot training, and when during a physical they found that my eyes were not suitable, I enlisted to become an aircraft mechanic. For his after being processed, they were sent to Camp Adams Camp to Shepherd Field in Texas, Wichita Falls, Texas, where I went through mechanic school and was selected to become an instructor. Others in the class were shipped out to various Air Force installations and became, in time, with combat. I spent a good share of time teaching others to become mechanics. I've been there when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, and that accelerated the whole process. And after remaining at Shepherd Field for a good time as an instructor, I decided that I wanted to get out of that position, and I applied for OCS and went to Harvard Graduate School of Business to become a statistical control officer. And upon graduating from there, I shipped to the Southwest Pacific, Fifth Air Force, and after remaining there a while, I was asked to I was transferred to the South Pacific, headquartered in Caledonia, serving the South Pacific area in the new 13th Air Force. And, the island hop in Caledonia and the Guadalcanal, Morotai. I came back in 45, late 45, long enough to get married, the West Coast. I was the fiscal control officer at the San Bernardino Air Depot until I was discharged.
What year were you discharged?
I get a little confused with the accumulated time that I had. It was about a year after, about in late 1946.
Did you keep kosher before the war?
No. Well, when I grew up, my family kept kosher until the family tended to break up and tended to disperse. The only ones left were my mother and myself. And when I took her to Columbus during my last year at the college, we did not keep kosher. We have used kosher food. We have avoided the trade that is pork products, but we have not kept kosher.
Okay, when you came back from the war, did you get involved in any Jewish activities in Minnesota?
Yep. Again, you have to take those years in context of what was going on in the world. That was the period immediately following the Second World War, with the sudden horrible realization of what had happened to the Jews during the Holocaust, and the tremendous traumas involved in trying to save the remnants. There was a period during which there were negotiations and deliberations and political maneuvering going on to see that upon the end of the British mandate in Palestine, that there would be a Jewish home, a good place for Jews to go. And we get involved in a lot of that sort of thing at that time. I've been very active in the Zionist Organization in America. We organized a youth, or a young folks branch called Masada, which is made up of young singles and young marrieds. Activities ranged during those first couple of years from bringing speakers in, to raising money, to having dances, to write letters to the editors of the paper, to speak to other groups, to bring pressure on politicians, and writing to the president, and to the secretary of state, and representatives, and the senators, and to the newly formed United Nations, and all those good things. With the imminent establishment of the State of Israel, however, we were asked, given a challenge at that time, to do something practical and meaningful, and that was to get arms for the Jews of the kibbutzim at that time. England had established a policy of confiscating all guns from the kibbutzim, and the defenses in the face of the invasion of the Arabs upon the state of Israel in 1988. And for that period from late 47 to early 48, we went from door to door asking people to give us their souvenir guns and whatever else they brought back in the Second World War. We accumulated a lot of such stuff, which we would put in crates, mark radio parts, and ship them to an address in New York, where they were sorted out and repacked and reshipped to Israel.
When you say you went door to door, do you mean just the Jewish house?
No. No, you gotta understand, at that time, the people were aware that less than 1.5 million Jews in Israel were fighting 80 million Arabs intent on pushing them into the Mediterranean. And the Americans have always been in favor of the underdog. So there were a lot of people who were sympathetic to that point of giving up souvenir guns. Whether they would have gone beyond that is unnecessary.
These souvenir guns, could you give some examples of the type of guns that you...
Oh, I got everything from 22s to Mausers, and 45s, you know, American GI-issued guns, Japanese guns, all with different size ammunition. And we quickly got the ammunition. When this was all came to a point, there was sorted out, and it turned out that the ammunition was almost every piece that they got. We got some big stuff, Tommy guns, rifles, submachine guns. We even got enough pieces in various places to put together a triangulation for artillery, field radios, and telephones, forward. You have to realize this is a period when the Jews trying to defend themselves in Israel were resorting to being howitzers out of pieces of pipe. It would run from one kibbutz to another kibbutz clear across the country in the middle of the night, so the Arabs would think they were hard at both places, shooting off firecrackers over a loudspeaking system, so the Arabs would think they had ammunition to get it. I like to think that what he did at that time. Had a large part in saving him from Jewish community in Palestine at that time.
Could you tell me about how many people were involved in this effort?
Locally?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Masada Club, I believe, had about 60 to 70 members, but this work was done by a handful, maybe 5 or 6 of us.
And how was the how were the weapons transported to New York?
Well, we took them downtown to the store, the Stelton Radio Arts, who was involved in things, and we boxed them, traded them, marked them as Radio Arts, shipped them to a counterpart in New York, and there people picked them up and tossed them and reshipped them. And we didn't know, we didn't want to know who it was or where it was, because the people knew what was going on to save the operation.
Do you have any estimate of how many guns that you collected, how many weapons?
No. But I would say we probably shipped out of here counting all kinds of things, not ammunition, but things like field radios and that. Probably close to 200
pieces. Were there other groups from the various other synagogues working on the same item, the same thing at the same time?
No, this is not a synagogue issue. This was a ZOA, this organization, operation. People who belong to our organization would belong to the various temples. It had nothing to do, it wasn't religious. At that time, as a matter of fact, the dome, which was still officially not Zionist. They were no longer anti-Zionist. In a period of time, their philosophy was that we should find a home for the Jews, but not a homeland. Well, this changed a lot since then.
What did you do after that? We're up to about 48 now. Did you stay in the Youngstown area?
I stayed in the Youngstown area until about 1953, with the Aldo Packing Company headquarters here. 1953, we moved the main office to the factory in Springboro, Pennsylvania, and I moved to Meadville. The reason I moved to Meadville was one of the other men in the organization was hired to come to Springboro from Michigan. And he came to Springboro and found half of the duplex, and his family moved in. A couple of evenings later, there was a knock on the door, and the horn down the stand and said, "Mr. Blum, I'm Reverend Marcel. The church invited him in, and he says, I stopped by to find out whether we can expect to see him in the church next Sunday. Well, Sherman Blum said, Brother Marshall, you know we're Jewish, don't you? And he said, really? What about it? Well, this is related to me, why I made up my mind that was no place for me. Jewish boy. I moved to Meadville, which is about 18 miles away, but you required me to move to the community. And then Herman Blum also moved to Meadville shortly after that. Because we would have been sort of freaks in the community. Despite the fact that the people seemed to know that the Jew owned the factory in which they worked, they had no concept of. Where Jew was.
Was there a large Jewish community in Asia?
Yes, all 11 families were living there.
Did you continue in Jewish activity in Asia?
It became more active, actually. I taught Sunday school, both at Little Shul, both at the Emmanuel and at Yom. And at that time in Louisville, they had a small Sunday school in the Pentagriff room, which were above a bar in downtown Louisville. And on Sundays, they used to have class there. A very heterogeneous group with a gal who had been a teacher. But it wasn't too successful when they heard I'd been Sunday school teacher. They asked me if I would help, which I did, and I gradually began to change the curriculum and they thought I was a great innovator. And when we decided to try to build ourselves a temple or a community center, I became active in the building campaign and brought in resources for young people to help. We built ourselves a temple, a center actually with a chapel in it, and I suddenly found myself in charge of the Sunday school, in charge of the ritual committee and learning services. I became second president of the congregation. So that, I was quite active in the community. We all were. The community group, about 30 families, 35 families, and I was back. Actually, everything we did those first year, we did together. Billy Green, what was Yom Kippur, whatever it was. Some of the temples of all the women pitched in the kitchen, the men did the maintenance work. And it was a very stimulating time. I understand that they're back down to 11 families. Which is important.
When did you return to Youngstown?
I returned to Youngstown in 1965.
And did you get immediately involved with the Jewish community while you were there?
Yeah, I became involved in the Federation campaign time. I made my contribution in the Sioux Falls to Fallon. But I was working for Central Enterprises at the time until I was approached by the staff of the Federation, whom I used as resources at the time. They were organizing in Meadville and approached about whether I would consider coming to work there because of my background. And after some deliberation, my wife's finding herself a job to compensate for the loss of wages, which I experienced, I agreed to hope twice a week during the day, and then I go home and have a drink at the center. Teenagers, including Neil Yudkin.
When was the Jewish Center originally organized?
If you don't count the Youngstown Hebrew Institute for school. The first center in this town was located on Chrysler Street. Near the campus now. 635 or 536 or something like that. In a house. And it's 1935. And it stayed there till 1954 when the building was achieved.
You've been a Jewish educator in the Temple and Sunday School, so on, for a number of years. Can you describe the differences in Jewish education from when you were a student and today, for example?
Outside of the difference in perception between being a student and being a teacher, I would say that back in 1920s and 30s, Jewish education, by and large, outside of Sunday schools, which volunteer and parents, was placed in the hands of what we call mamonas, who were almost like chinna teachers. Very few of them who had any kind of degree or special training in education, but who had adopted Jewish education as a career. They would come and stay in the community for a short time and then move on. Of course, they were augmented by the people in the community who, out of their own commitment, certainly after the kind of data was given, were teachers, and guys. The Malamites, usually stayed maybe a matter of months or years, 2 years, and then moved on somewhere else. And they came from everywhere, from Palestine, from New York, from any metropolitan area where Jews could get a heavy Jewish education. And some were good, some were lousy. Then gradually, after the Hebrew to close the stores, the Catholic Hebrew education went back to temples. And there they again lean heavily on volunteers, or lightly paid volunteers, from the when I started to teach the Sunday school, it was $5 at the Sunday school. Of course, a lot of this was because of the fact that no one temple had a lot of students, and the parents wouldn't permit the payment of the kind of money that was necessary for a professional teacher. Recently, about 2 years ago, we woke up again. After we've learned the previous 10, 12 years by some leadership to the fact that these kids were not getting a decent Jewish education. But you can't teach a combination of ages at one time or a small class, anything that's come on once a week or twice a week, a few times a week basis, especially using volunteer type teachers who tend to do the chapter involved on Saturday sometime, and even try to teach something on Sunday. Because they're just not getting what they needed. And as a result of that, the Commission for Jewish Education in Youngstown was organized, and they established a community after the public school class, school, which made up of a combination of all the three remaining active temples, that is, Lord Tzedek, Dalema, and Rosh Hashon. And by combining the resources, it is is going to be subsidized by the Jewish Federation. So there's contributions in the Jumps National Federation, which made up their budget. On that basis, they were able to go out and hire professional Jewish teachers, people who were trained as teachers and people who were trained in Jewish subjects. And that now exists at Mitzvah Temple in Alabama. Kids go two nights a week, two evenings a week, plus they have to go to the Sunday school. So they have three schools a week to teach education, which is not enough, but it's better than what it had been previously. And I see it because since I came back to Youngstown, I've been helping the services of Heritage Manor. And we used to get AGA and the others to bring their kids in and they could have a safe offer. Now we got ministers who can conduct local service. They come, they can shop us, or they'll do this stuff. We can turn. And it's kind of different. Now, how important is it to have a youngster who can recite all the prayers, conduct the service, as compared to one who has acquired a Jewish heart, Jewish understanding, Jewish history and tradition, and all those kind of things? I'm not prepared to say it this time. I don't know how good a job to do.
So basically, they reinstalled the classes that you had when you were growing up. So they can slap.
It's almost a corresponding sort of thing. So the type of direction, the type of teaching is much higher, more professional. On the other hand, the element that's missing now that was there was the motivation, the discipline, the family support. By that I mean, in those days, if I didn't behave in school, I'd probably get whacked a couple times and I could have never reported to home and thought, go to bed without supper, whatever. Nowadays, the teacher raises a hand to a student, the family's up in arms, and if the child requires discipline, the leadership is involved, and the question is, which is more important, to have decorum in the class, or to have this, and to have the family resign from the temple? It's a real problem. Same kind of problem, just the public schools. Public schools have a kind of support for that. At home, but they are different.
Do you see then a difference in the commitment of parents and to the Jewishness of the child?
Yes. Much more oppressive society. And it's cumulative. We, the parents, rebelled as youngsters. And though there was at that time much more discipline in the family than there is now, fact is that we all edged a little further away from being strict observant Jews. So we made the first step. I'm sure they had made a small step themselves from their family traditions, especially when they came to America. And our kids could have gone further, now they're continuing to go further, and one has to worry about whether there will be ancestry issues in the future.
Going back to the Jewish Center, have the programs with this center itself changed since you've come back?
Yeah, they've changed since I'm back. They've changed drastically from the beginning of the movement. You have to understand that the beginning of the movement was the Jewish Community Center was a settlement house. It was a place where these Eastern European people with their houses and their black hats and frock coats and cinches hanging out and all that. But, excuse me, what was that? The fringes, the cinches from the tosses they wore under their clothes. Z-I-D-Z-I-S. They wanted to become Americans, and more important, I would say, there were many Jews who were priests who had come before them. Had become fairly well assimilated, and they were more ashamed of the European Jew, and they wanted to get oriented and assimilated as quickly as they could. And the response to that was the formulation of what were then called settlement houses, in which Jews were the pioneers. They had classes to teach English, classes to teach civics, classes the Constitution, classes to how to live, how to furnish a home, how to be an American. And the whole emphasis was on assimilation. Then, as the second generation started to come through, you didn't need to learn English because you spoke English. They were Americans, their friends were Americans. It became a recreational place. Leisure time activity sort of thing, where you learn to do things that you didn't learn in school. You might have typing classes, you might have art classes, you might have
ballet yarn classes.
This is a graduate thing from the 20s up to the Second World War. And where you came and played ping pong and dancing, you got a school for this man. Had a gym, you played basketball, that was a big thing, of course. You had lectures, so on. After the Second World War, substantially after, the movement suddenly became aware of the fact that we were contributing to the dissolution of the American Jewish community. We were doing everything we could to make everybody in the same mold and to minimize Jewishness. The programs of the Jewish Community Center then began to change direction for Jewish content. The Jewish content watching that we didn't step on the toes of the temple and get involved in liturgy and theology. But nevertheless, Jewish tradition, we did observe all the holidays and have programs around the holidays, but not as religious activities, but as recreational, educational, informational kind of. So that's where we are now, concerned about security and the viability to continue the existence of the Jewish community.
In walking through the center the other day, I noticed the top floor has been converted into a Christian school. When did that come about?
Well, Jewish preschool was always on the top floor, Neil, except back in your time, as soon as we were moving up. As soon as the clubs were done and left the place to make this crew, descended on those rooms, removed the chairs and put preschool furniture in the next morning. And they had preschool the next morning, and the next night they could be back into meeting rooms. But two things happened. Number one, the number of teenage Jews got sharper. And many of the clubs went out of distance, actually all of them except for the 1AZA and 1DDG. to offer meat to consumers 9 or 10 people, so that it was no longer feasible to dedicate those rooms for that purpose. And so the preschool department requested and granted permission to make it a permanent preschool situation, get the decorations and all that stuff, and the room was there, the workers cost me. This location, I'm hoping to figure out where they put this yesterday, I need it today. So it's a, not just a preschool, but we, the kids have it downstairs in the library, the square room, and that's all I need.
Is this specifically a Jewish preschool? And what forms of Judaism does it teach?
It teaches about Judaism. It doesn't teach Judaism. They observe all the holidays and the Seder, and they honor the Purim, and they sing the songs, and so on. But they tell the story of Sukkot, they tell the story of Purim, they tell the story of Pesach. And there are some humorous results. The preschool at the Jewish Community Center has become almost like a miniature international institute. When a doctor gets positioned here at the North Side Hospital, for instance, or at St. E's, from India, China, Taiwan, South America, wherever they come from, they report first to the office. There they're helped to find a home. And then they, if they have children of preschool age, they're steered to the community center, which is the place for them to go. So they come here barely able to speak English, with no concept whatsoever of the American way of life. And they become Americanized. They become Americanized as a side effect, believing that the Sukkot is an American thing, and the Passover is an American holiday. And that's something I wonder how long it takes them to realize that ain't so.
Excuse me, could you explain what the Sukkot is?
The Sukkot is a booth or hut of some kind, which is erected just outside the home of the institution for the holiday of Sukkot, to commemorate the fact that the Jews lived there for 40 years in tents and huts made out of whatever it is. Sides from the surrounding wilderness, that they looked up at the stars and therefore that they could see through the top. And that in the years afterward, when there was, when Israel existed, the biblical states, people would come for the three pilgrimages each year. Obviously, there weren't enough hotels around to accommodate them, so they would build themselves these food shacks. So that we, today, build a four-sided shack just outside the library, the lounge of the center, and we spread ears of corn, and stalks of corn across the top and branches, so that it's supposed to be food. Decorated with fruit and vegetables, because it was a harvest holiday. And the youngsters, of course, come and visit for decorations and so on.
Thank you. You mentioned that a number of non-Jewish children were belong to the preschool. Is there a lot of children of non-Jews in the center?
Yes, a large number. Sufficient number that we're concerned. We have an open membership policy, but we do not recruit non-Jewish families. The center is subsidized by the Jewish community through a campaign people what member pays in the way of membership, just barely pays for the light bill. Most of it's subsidized. And nevertheless, if a non-Jewish family becomes a member, they have to all the same privileges as a Jewish family. So it's really a bargain for them. About 40% of them.
And could you describe some of the other programs that the center uses? Could you describe some of the other programs that the center has that are Jewish oriented?
Well, even the swimming in the gym, as far as we're concerned, is Jewish oriented because we think it's installed in the usually take the Jewish name. Sometimes they take the Panthers and Tigers and that kind of stuff. We try to run contests on the basis of Jewish name for brackets and that kind of stuff in the tournaments. The stuff in the preschool, all the way down the line. The kids in the arts and crafts classes, for instance, can make any e-books or recollection of the wall. During Federation, they made a paper-shaped tree with the branches and sold leaves. So the quarter of 60 gave that money to the Jewish National Fund. The Tuba Stuff, which is a Jewish holiday. Of course, when you have Chinese, I guess, there's nothing Jewish about that, I'm sure. And there's nothing Jewish about the weaving classes. But the fact is that they generally make something that's Jewish or Jewish purposes. Hanging in the house, moving above, or something like that. And then, of course, most of my lectures are based on Jewish topics. The anti-Semitism, what's going on in the Middle East, Jewishly oriented. Because artists who bring in either are Jewish or have Jewish content program. For instance, Sunday we have the Quartet and the Amstrad Symphony. And one of them is Jewish, you know, I'm not sure. But they're going to be playing some Jewish numbers, especially with the occasion for the cake and the stuff. Like the heavy new family.
You seem to be skeptical about where the Jewish community is going. Do you see any hope for it at all?
Oh, definitely hope, but I think the leadership has to become a little more concerned, a little more alarmed than it is now. We're working desperately to think of ways of improving. It's basically the family. You know, the program, for instance, we had Thursday night, we call our Educate the Family Living, which is done together with the Jewish Family and Children's Service, all of us, part of the Jewish Federation. We brought in Dr. Irving Greenberg, who is top man in the field probably in the whole country. Last night we had, or Thursday night we had a young lady, lovely social worker from Cleveland, who conducts this kind of thing. And she, her session, which is a group experiential a group that became involved, group involvement, I should say, on intermarriage. The problem, how they handle, how traumatic it should be, and all these kind of things. Yeah, The average non-Jew who applies for membership knows he's getting into a Jewish atmosphere. We tell them. You understand that they're going to be talking about and celebrating Jewish holidays, and the kids are going to be singing Jewish songs, their Jewish decorations, for Hanukkah, and for this and that, and they won't be Christmas, they won't be Easter, and so forth. And in terms of group work, you can just excuse the non-Jewish kids and talk to the Jewish kids, and they're going to be participating and exposed to the stories of the holiday. Fine, no, that's exactly what we want, huh? Fine, there's a card sign. But as I said, as much as you try to do it, swimming in the gym,
thank you very much, sir.
Okay.